The Biden administration is charting a new American industrial strategy. At the center of this strategy sits a historic piece of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act. I'm Lauren Reese, and you're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. In today's episode, we're featuring a conversation between John Podesta, Senior Advisor to the President for Clean Energy Innovation and Implementation, and Wilson Center Vice President Duncan Wood on what the Inflation Reduction Act means for the U.S. and for the U.S.'s relationships with partners and allies around the world.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, John. I'd like to pick up from one of the points that you made. Obviously, the Inflation Reduction Act, as a Brit, it's still difficult for me to call it the IRA, growing up as I did in the 1980s, but that's another issue. The Inflation Reduction Act, you said, you know, is a historical...
We definitely try to avoid that with
yes,
British colleagues.
it's a historical piece of legislation. When I talk about it with folks, I actually say that this is a seismic event. It's a seismic event in terms of the scale of the fiscal incentives that are there, the package. It's also a seismic event in terms of the shockwaves that it has sent throughout the U.S. economy, but also throughout the world. You mentioned that there have been some criticisms, and perhaps you know some of those are that the United States is engaging in a new form of protectionism by providing these incentives. We've certainly seen that the initial reaction to the Inflation Reduction Act from countries like Japan, Korea, the European Union, many others, was, you know, how could the Americans go ahead and do this, you know, without talking to us first? And, you know, then there was a moment of realization, okay, well, it's happened, so we need to, you know, start talking with the Americans about this. I wonder if you could take a second to talk about what's happening on that level, the ongoing negotiations and conversations with partner countries. And also, you know, perhaps to remind folks how the Inflation Reduction Act stands to benefit not just the United States economy, but how there is built in a process that will benefit the rest of the world.
Great. Let me take that on directly. I would say it wasn't that they weren't talked to. It's maybe they didn't believe we would actually get it done. And I think there were a lot of people in the United States who probably began to doubt that it was possible as well. This was a piece of legislation that was kind of like the perils of Pauline. It had, you know, it kept dying at the end of every congressional work period. And then finally, we struck a deal and secured the last vote, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, to pass the legislation that contained this investment environment that I described. The bulk of the work is being done in the form of tax benefits to private sector deployment of capital, production tax credits, investment tax credits, et cetera. There's also a significant amount of grant money to try to spur innovation in the clean tech sector that's being deployed by the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Commerce, and others. It fits with the strategy that's embedded in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the CHIPS and Science Act to try to create more of a better investment environment in the United States. We're open to foreign direct investment. But obviously, I think economies in both in Asia and Europe and really across the globe were concerned that we were paying the most significant attention to investment in the United States through provisions like a bonus credit for domestic content, et cetera, that's embedded in the law. We've been in dialogue with our key trading partners over time. The structure of the law gives benefits to countries, particularly in this critical minerals question that you focused on and that we've been focusing on, by giving benefit to minerals that are mined or processed in countries with which the United States has a free trade agreement. That obviously included Mexico and Canada through the USMCA. It included South Korea as a result of the fact that we had a free trade agreement with South Korea. With Japan, we struck an early deal building on an agricultural trade agreement that we had to make, again, minerals and components that are mined or processed in Japan eligible for that. As I noted in my speech, we're in deep conversation with the European Union. That's been ongoing really since kind of right after the bill passed. We've done that at both the European level, and we've been engaged at the national level with governments in Europe. Our strategy is to see industrialization and the electrification and the decarbonization of economies across the globe prosper. One of the effects, I think, of the bill, BCG estimated that it will reduce the cost for clean energy deployment by 25% globally, which is a global public good, quite frankly. By the United States making that investment, creating that cycle of investment, innovation, and cost reduction, it makes clean energy, it makes that green premium that Bill Gates loves to talk about, go down further. And we're already seeing, and we're seeing this globally, that solar is the cheapest new form of electricity production in the globe today, and that's why you've seen this huge jump in the percentage of new power production being solar, as the IEA just reported. And I think we're even going further. We're going further across a range of technologies that are going to be necessary in a new decarbonized, and particularly as we get towards mid-century and try to hit net zero targets, we're going to need the kind of investment that we're doing here on green hydrogen, on direct air capture, on the ability to support carbon capture and sequestration and utilization. And so the structure of the bill will spur investment here. And quite frankly, the president makes no apologies for using U.S. tax dollars to support investment in the United States, and has encouraged his partners and allies to do the same thing. And we're seeing a reaction to that, both in Europe, as I noted, but across the globe, in Canada and in other countries who are saying, we want to be part of this future. We need to adjust our investment strategies, our sustainable development strategies in order to meet that goal. It's not the only thing we need to do. I mean, we still have a huge finance challenge, particularly in the developing economies, for developing economies, one that we need to step up to and meet. That'll be a topic of, I think, focus and conversation at the upcoming COP. This is not just a matter of developing the best technology. You got to be able to finance the deployment, and the United States has a deep responsibility to make sure it's doing its part. I think that the president's nomination, I think is the right word, of Ajay Banga, I think was a step in the right direction. I think we need the World Bank to be a leader, not a laggard, in this effort. But what that goal really needs to be is to unlock private capital to flow into those markets. That's a huge challenge, but one that the United States has an obligation to participate in as we invest here, drive our emissions down, and drive the cost of clean energy down.
So, I mean, you touched on a number of the points that I want to bring up next, and focusing on the question of partnerships.
I'll try to be briefer.
No. You've provided the perfect segue. In terms of the partnership between the United States and the European Union and other international allies, of course, how do we sort of bring the different development financing programs, the different strategies on securing critical minerals, the different strategies on the processing and refining of those? How do we bring that all together into a package which is really compelling for developing countries, emerging markets in particular, where there is an abundance of both mineral riches, but also investment opportunities and the need for that kind of financing. And how do we put that together in a way which is compelling in contrast to what China is doing?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to show up. You know, I think there was literally a decade in which China was scouring the globe. And the reason, as I noted, they control those investments in that supply was they were there making investments. And I think it wasn't for lack of knowledge. I think it was for the lack of the long-term strategy that began to see what that dependence would feel like in you know, sort of a decade hence. I think now, particularly in Europe and in North America and in Asia, there's a sense that this is an intolerable reliance. It's not like China's not going to be part of the global economy. They're leaders in electric vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to we can't be and again, the Ukraine war taught us a lesson of what overdependence on a single country that in the end of the day was unreliable could mean, given the shock to the system that Europe experienced with the invasion of Ukraine. And so what we need to do is to reduce that dependency by trying to find partnerships. It's a difficult task, I think, because both in Europe and the U.S., we want to see, and it's critical that we ensure that we pay attention to labor protection, to human rights violations, et cetera, and particularly in these mining sectors. Transparency and abuse of workers is a kind of constant challenge. But I think the market for those materials draws, I think, other countries in, and I think our development finance institutions, the DFC here, the other big development finance institutions, together with the international financial institutions, have to come to grips with the mission remains sustainable development. And creating pathways towards clean energy development that works simultaneously on the climate problem has to be part of that. And I think the collaboration, cooperation, co-financing, particularly on strategies that begin to spur more private sector flows into those economies is going to be critical to that.
I love what you started on the answer to that question, which is that we've got to show up. I think that there's also been, and what I've heard from many of the folks I speak to from mineral-rich emerging markets, is they say, listen, we don't want to have a repetition of the classic extractive relationship that we've seen in the past. We want to develop relationships. We want to develop partnerships, and there needs to be something, some value added for us as well.
That's an advantage, actually, we have on China, because I think we can actually begin to offer that.
Exactly. And that brings me to one of the other points that you mentioned, which is this tie-in with social and labor rights, which, of course, has been one of the themes of this administration here in the United States and one of the themes of the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, how can this model of linking climate measures with community and worker protections be featured in the climate diplomacy with mineral-producing countries? And specifically, how is that an advantage of what we may have over what China is offering?
First of all, we have to get our own act together, I would say, first and foremost. And I think that's Europe's been ahead of the U.S. on that. I think the U.S. has gotten into that game with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act and its emphasis and support for making investments in disadvantaged communities, in energy communities, in the communities that have been left behind, and putting features of labor protection into the statute in the form of advancing it's in the form of support for companies' investment paying attention to labor protection. I think first and foremost, the bonus credit for paying a prevailing wage, for using certified apprentices, for building out apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship and community benefits agreements in communities will have a profound effect on where investments are made and the quality of the jobs that are being created. So we're quite excited about that. And I think it's a strategy that's different, new, and that President Biden has really leaned heavily into. And I think it's we're seeing the signs of success, as I said, around the country. But when it comes, and I think Europe's on its own journey in terms of trying to deploy its capital in a way that provides a just transition for its workers across the union, and other countries as well. I mean, I'm sure that'll be a topic of discussion between the prime minister and the president today as they meet. But when it comes to trying to ensure that we're lifting up working to secure protections for the people at the end of the chain in the developing economies of the world that have resources, I think that our proposition is that this is a stronger model of growth and sustainable development. We have to be trying to work in partnership to ensure that those, at times I think people have viewed that as a kind of protectionist measure, but I think if you flip that on its head, use the framework of the Sustainable Development Goals, bring people up, try to deploy both private sector capital, but particularly public capital, in a way that calls on both transparency and regimes to lift the standards. There's a proposition that the markets of Europe and the U.S., Canada, Australia, etc., are open to products from those countries, and I think that's a competitive advantage that we have in terms of a development model that's going to be attractive in many, many places.
And I would posit as well that the fact is that because we're going to be working so closely with the private sector from the U.S., from Europe, and around the world, the private sector of these countries have much higher standards, more dedicated to ESG principles, and will leave a more positive legacy behind than their Chinese counterparts. And that's one of the things I think is fundamentally important, but one of the messages we need to get out there, which is that, you know, American companies and European companies have their own internal norms and standards to do with transparency and accountability, which Chinese firms simply don't. And that's one of the things that we can certainly bring to the table. John, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I know you have to run off to another meeting,
great.
But it's been great to have you here.